This is not a rubric on the liturgical calendar, but I guess this is Southern Day in this room after our notable worship led by our Virginian. We have a Tennessean for our lecturer. He graduated from Roanoke College in Virginia and from the seminary of the United Lutheran Church in Philadelphia, and has pursued graduate studies both at the University of Tennessee and the University of Chicago. His doctorate is an honorary degree from Wittenberg College and University now. After pastorates of many years, he became a teacher in functional fields at Maywood. And if anybody wants to tell you that a man can't do a good job also after quite a few years at it, then don't look at me, but look at Dr. Davis. He's, I guess, about in his 25th year at Maywood, something
That's
like
right.
that, isn't it?
That's
Just
correct.
Imagine. So we're helping him with his Jubilee year. On this campus, Dr. Davis is known as the author of a textbook which I think everybody, at least beginning in the second year, uses around here, Designed for Preaching. And this is a very precious introduction to the particular gifts and gift of Dr. Davis to the church. And I hope we don't ruin it by using the gift between the covers of a textbook. For my colleagues who may not have used this book, and for first-year men who have not yet seen it, I'm going to take the liberty of infringing on Dr. Davis's time and read the poem. He claims he didn't try to write a poem when he produced these lines, but he surely succeeded, which describe what he thinks is the design of a sermon. I'm going to present this because I think we'll get a quick clue to Dr. Davis. He's in our midst today not for the sake of technique of preaching or technical side of theology, but this wispy, this fragile thing that is hard to pin in words, the cultural components, particularly the musical, of worship, and how these two things blend in his mind, that he's a man not only of the content of words, but of the feeling of form, will get introduced to us by this. A sermon should be like a tree. It should be a living organism, with one sturdy thought like a single stem, with natural limbs reaching up into the light. It should have deep roots, as much unseen as above the surface, roots spreading as widely as its branches spread, roots deep underground in the soil of life's struggle, in the subsoil of the eternal word. It should show nothing but its own unfolding parts, branches that thrust out by the force of its inner life, sentences like leaves native to this very spray, true to the species, not taken from alien growths. Illustrations like blossoms opening from inside those very twigs, not brightly colored kites pulled from the wind of somebody else's thought entangled in these branches. It should bear flowers and fruit at the same time, like the orange, having something for food, for immediate nourishment. having something for delight, for present beauty and fragrance, for the joy of hope, for the harvest of a distant day. To be all this, it must grow in a warm climate, in loam enriched by death, in love like the all-seeing and all-cherishing sun, in trust like the sleep-sheltering night, in pity like the rain. Now, Dr. Davis is not only a poet, and this is the peculiar thing about him, that he can be more than one man. He is a very fine, hard-nosed technician as a teacher and as a theologian. He prepared for his church back in 1952 a little treatise on the ministry in the New Testament. 26 slender pages, which were so noteworthy that his own colleagues went to the trouble and expense of publishing them and discussing them, which is pretty high praise from a faculty, let me tell you. And it's still one of the finest things on the ministry. A biblical theology of the ministry and the church that you will find anywhere. Dr. Davis has doubled in homiletics and in liturgics, and today he's particularly on the worship side of the spectrum. I'll remind once more at the close of this hour of his other appearances in our midst today. At this time, we are ready to hear his convocation lecture, which is Worship Music in a Synthetic Culture. Dr. Davis.
After that impossible introduction, it's going to be pretty hard to speak to you like a man, I fear. Of course, you all know the love of Professor Kimmerer's heart and how to listen
and to discount it at the same time, perhaps. I thank you. Your valued invitation asked me to speak to you on some subject of my own choosing within the area of worship and culture. I have chosen this subject of worship music in a synthetic culture because I have deep concern about this question, not primarily as a musician. I'm not in trouble with this question as a musician, but primarily as a man of the church. I think there is a concern. I think there are questions about this subject, which are of vital concern to the whole church, all of us together. And I know no place in the United States of America where I think the kind of questions I want to raise today will get a fairer and more intelligent hearing than they would get on the Concordia campus. I shall address myself, I shall be speaking particularly this morning to those of you who do not think of yourselves as musicians. I hope I do not give you a wrong impression when I speak of our culture as a synthetic culture. I do not mean either to condemn it or to praise it. I suspect that there may be one or two aspects of our culture that perhaps fall a little short of perfection, but I do not now intend the word synthetic as a term of disparagement. On the contrary, some things in our synthesis seem to me to be quite clearly gains of no slight importance, but I am not inclined to brag about it either. I use the term synthetic culture for what it is worth as a descriptive term. What I mean by it will, I hope, become clear as we discuss the question of church music. The condition I have particularly in mind is the result of course, of modern developments in transportation and particularly in photography and the reproduction of sound. I think these things have brought on a critical situation which calls for a reconsideration of a good many things. This is an absolutely unprecedented condition. Images of sight and sound from 100 cultures, traditional ways in art and craft and thought and manners come together in our living rooms, and our experience is a synthesis of them all, or we hope it may become a synthesis. Jacqueline Kennedy deplanes in India, and we not only see her and the crowds and the buildings of India, but we also hear the plaintive flute speaking a musical language so strange that we do not know whether they are affirming or protesting. Multiplied 100 times and varied in 1,000 ways, these impressions do not leave us as we were before. Any American's taste in the arts is likely to bring together unrelated bits from all over the world and all periods of history. Mine, for example. There on the mantel is a neck-stretching crane hand-carved from black buffalo horn by an anonymous artisan in South India. There hangs a wooden mask from the island of Bali, a face which apparently reflects something amusing, but is very, very non-committal about it. Here is the St. James Boanerges by the second Richard Kemmerer, which I bought in your bookstore. There is a Christ on the cross by George Rouault, number 57 of his Miserere. And here between bookcases hangs a page of the Nuremberg Chronicle with accounts and woodcuts of three worthies and an eclipse of the sun that occurred at the sixth hour on August 28, 1448. And I shudder to think what this collection could do to me in the hands of a Freudian analyst. The stock of photographic images in the brain of an American, the stuff of his visual memory and imagination, is drawn from all races and climes and from all periods of history that have left monuments on its surface or under the surface of this planet. This synthesis or concatenation, whatever you wish to call it, synthesis is a very doubtful word maybe, this synthesis imposes the necessity of eclecticism. It has everything to do with the way we build churches today. And what is much more important in my judgment, it has everything to do with the way we look at churches and use them after they are built. The architect only designs and builds the church. It is the people who must make it an instrument of worship. But our concern today is with music. Audible images of memory and imagination. What the National Geographic and other magazines have for many years been doing to our eyes. The radio and the phonograph and the tape recorder are now doing to our ears. An urban American can hear a wider variety of music in a week than his grandfather could hear in a whole lifetime, and many of them of us do it. It is not only music from all contemporary cultures. It is from all the centuries backward, as far as there are written documents for the musicologist to work on. When my wife tunes in the early morning program on our FM station, which she does every morning, as soon as she comes downstairs, breaks into my work, we may, of course, hear anything at all this side of Haydn and Mozart, but we are quite as likely to hear Handel and Bach, or Vivaldi, or Corelli, or Heinrich Schietz, or Gabrieli. We heard Gabrieli yesterday morning. Or Palestrina, or Josquin des Prez. And on occasions that are not very rare, it may be music even older than this. Dufay in the 1400s, Michaud in the 1300s, or early polyphony of the School of Notre Dame in Paris, when that cathedral was still unfinished and Thomas Aquinas was still unborn. Think of that. And the unprecedented thing about our cultural situation is that all this music is accessible, not in manuscripts anymore, and printed scores for the use of professional or semi-professional musicians, but is accessible as living sound, after a fashion, for anyone who has ears to hear it. Because the variety of accessible music is so great, different persons in our Sunday congregations come with musical experiences and tastes as different as if they lived in different worlds. The churchgoers' musical standards and ideals are no longer limited as they once were to the music performed in the churches and schools and other occasional events in his community, no longer. All this raises questions about the music of worship in our churches. Many of these questions have to do with historical and theoretical matters, musical matters, in which I cannot expect all of you to be interested, and these I shall not go into. These are the matters, this is the area in which I think I am not very uneasy as a musician, not troubled as a musician. Yet the music of worship is of vital concern to us all, as, for example, church architecture is of vital concern to us all. The question about how church about church architecture have been raised, I think, and are being raised, and they are being faced, and even answered, interestingly, if not always, with entire success. That would be too much to expect. I do not think the question of church music has yet been raised with equal clarity. I wish to raise a question or two about it. First, that is the professional music of the organ and choir, the special music this lovely music in this chapel this morning, this profoundly worshipful music in this chapel this morning, all of it, and maybe especially the violin and oboe, this music in which the church's part is to listen and not to participate in a performance. Here, any sensible person, I think, can only rejoice at the greatly enriched repertoire made possible by the new interest in older music. Fine music of the past is not only available for performance, it has improved the quality of contemporary compositions. The Word of God and the Gospel of Christ can speak in our churches in a voice more worthy of its ageless power. We rejoice at this. Yet let us face the fact that the taste for music, for such music as this, is an acquired taste in America. This music does not speak to everyone alike. It is not music for everyone alike, I think. It is professional music developed in Western and European culture, and its full appreciation calls for some practice. Calls for a person who is a music fan in some sense of the word. Calls for a semi-professional listener, perhaps. A person with whom so-called serious music is a special interest or hobby that distinguishes him from those about him and perhaps makes him an oddball. In my granddaughter Florence's gang at high school, rock and roll was the thing last year, and is of course for everybody because everybody got a little talking box now. All the students in Chicago have nearly all of them. I do not know what it is this season, but I do know that recently, when Florence was overheard humming a Beethoven theme in the hall, she would have died rather than have told her classmates what it was. Now, I am quite sure that we shall go right on using the very best music we can in our churches, and I am quite sure that this is exactly what we ought to do. And in the long run, both Florence and her cronies will be glad of it if we do, of course. The worship of God should make high demands on us. It should stretch our minds and our hearts and our ears to larger dimensions. But I do not think we can afford to ignore the question raised by our cultural situation, or suppose that they have already been definitely answered. The question of music for the congregational's part in liturgical worship seems to me to be a far more critical question.
If the church is people, as we say it is, if the worship of God, the prayer, the praise, the thanksgiving, the confession, the self-commitment, if the worship must be not only congregational, but corporate, performed by all acting as one, not by the minister and choir while the people merely witness it, then The music needs to be a natural and spontaneous expression of what is deepest and most personal in us all. Now, where shall we look for music of this kind? This becomes a concern of the whole church, not just of professional church musicians. And of course, I come to you from one of the bodies that produced the new red book, you know. So this question is particularly present in my mind. Shall it be English chant, since we are worshiping in English? That makes a kind of sense. Shall it be unison melody, like the chorale of the German and Scandinavian tradition, since we are Lutherans? Shall it be Gregorian melody, since that has voiced the prayer of the Western Church for 1,000 years, and we are Westerners? Yeah. Theoretically, it may seem that the oldest church music, tried and proven by long use, must necessarily be the best. That is a widespread assumption, isn't it? Well, I think it isn't. In our context, the context of our subject this morning, I think it is a questionable assumption. Let me ask you to look at this question in the light of what we think about church architecture. If it is stultifying to imitate the style of medieval or Gothic architecture, why is it certainly wholesome to imitate the style and mood of medieval music? Or, to put the question less negatively, if the church of our day must find fresh, honest, and natural ways, contemporary ways of building, must she not find fresh, honest, and natural ways in musical expression? And if not, why not? If she can build freshly, why can she not sing the praise of God freshly? As a matter of fact, the attempt to recapture the past in music is more hopeless than in architecture, for the simple reason that Byzantine and Romanesque and Gothic ways of building have left monuments in substantial stone, which can be seen, measured, photographed. But ancient music has left no such monuments in sound. And music is sound. A manuscript or a printed score is not music. It's only the possibility of making a certain kind of music. Isn't music? We simply do not know how ancient Christian music sounded. Plain song, or Greek chant, or Syrian, or any other. We don't know for two reasons. First, there was no notation to show exactly how it went. And secondly, there was no assumption that music could be written exactly as it was sung, or that it should be sung exactly as written by everybody alike. Now, this is a very, very modern and a very, very Western notion indeed. And it was an unknown notion before the year 1000, shall we say. Plain song, for example, the only Gregorian music you and I have ever heard, is a 20th century reconstruction so far as sound is concerned.
It follows the interpretation of ancient manuscripts by antiquarians who do not always agree on their interpretation. And it is sung, whether at Solem or Buron or at Concordia, by voices trained in a European bel canto style of singing that should, as you're born, would have sounded very strange to the ears of medieval Christians. This is part of the cultural situation in which we're caught, it seems to me. Now, I hope that I may not be misunderstood at this point. I am not an enemy of Gregorian music. Rather, I'm a deep lover and a long-time lover of Gregorian music. I love Gregorian music as I love the sculpture and the stained glass of Chartres Cathedral. Nor am I opposed to its use in our worship, if we are to use any old music. And if, this is quite an iffy statement, and if it can be successfully divorced without permanent trauma from the Latin language and happily remarried to the English, I think that has not yet been done on any wide scale, and perhaps it has been done only, for I'm sure it has been done, but has done perhaps only with a few hymns and those simple and flexible melodies or intonations that we call the Gregorian tone. When Dr. Bouzine sets the text of an introit to one of these little tunes, he is working with the very oldest music in Christian history. Not Gregorian, strictly speaking, but older, much older than Gregory. The studies of such men as Kurt Sox, Edelson, Eric Werner, and Egan Vailish have traced these very tunes from the synagogue through the Eastern churches and languages and into the Latin Rite. It should not surprise us that if any old music at all can be a fit medium for the biblical text, it would be just this music. I'm not surprised at this at all. But the question, as I see it, is not which one of the older musical traditions the church should follow in its worship music, but whether it should attempt to perpetuate any of the older musical styles. The question is easier to raise than it is to answer. I do not come with an answer, for I do not think that any wholly satisfactory answer has yet begun to take shape. Maybe it has begun. I'm sure that it has begun to take shape with respect to the world of the musicians. Again, I have to make this distinction. Church is another matter. How different should the music of worship be from music outside the church? It can safely be said that in the past, every time the music of worship has renewed and enriched itself, it has done so not by a return to an older style of church music, but it has enriched itself by a synthesis of the best musical theory and practice known at the time and place outside the church as well as inside. This is what's happened. every time church music has renewed itself. And this is, of course, conspicuously true of the birth of Protestant music in the 16th century. It is also true that since the Renaissance, the greatest Christian music has been written by men who composed it very much as they composed music for use outside the church. How valid is the distinction then between sacred and secular in music, and still more importantly, just what is the distinction? In my judgment, it's got to be something else besides the reflection of the mood and mode of an ancient day. It may reflect that ancient day, but that's not the reason. Why does the best religious music from Mozart to Haydn and Haydn to Stravinsky and Poulenc get performed and heard only in the concert industry? And the recording and broadcast industry, and seldom, if ever, in the church, and if ever in the church, then in a sort of an artificial concert situation in the church. The people of Christ's church are, of course, a special people, a people called out, and you could say a peculiar people in their generation and culture, of course. The worship of God is not an ordinary activity like all the other activities that people engage in. The Word of God and the Gospel of Christ are not a consensus of the best thoughts and the dearest wishes of mankind ever, any time, in any culture. But must we require people to accept not only the gospel, the word of God and the gospel and the message it speaks to them, but also a peculiar and perhaps to them unnatural kind of music that goes along with them, and which strange music may be harder for them to hear than it is for them to hear the gospel themselves, itself? Must we? This question becomes crucial when we hear Christians in Africa and India and Japan trying to sing the praise of God in a musical language that is peculiar to West European culture. Then it becomes critical. Up to now, I have said nothing about current proposals to use popular music in the worship of the church. Theoretically, it might seem that this is the thing to do. If we had a traditional music that was vital, that was familiar and natural to us all, that belonged to the whole people, not just professional musicians and a few amateurs, if we had a music through which we were all accustomed to express our inner selves, then undoubtedly, in my opinion, this is the music out of which we should shape our praise. But one penalty of our synthetic or diffused culture is that we have no traditional music of this kind. You've got to have a professional or a semi-professional singing or playing a guitar before you can hear hillbilly music. Or you've got to get it on a commercial record. This is not folk music. Jazz is no more the music of all of us than is Latin American music, for example, or mountain music, or stage music, or folk ballads, or for that matter, Tchaikovsky, Brahms, and Bach. None of it is the music of us all. Now I have to stop this. Though we have only begun to inquire into the question of church music, I, of course, prefer to leave it here. Because I think the answer is not yet. Let me say only one thing that I deeply believe. I believe that the church is called of its Lord and its Christ and its God in this day, as in every day, to sing the praise of God freshly and from its whole and natural heart. In music that is an honest and a natural response to his grace and is our own response, not the imitation of some former response. And this doesn't mean that old music can't be used. I believe that when that is done, it will produce a real synthesis of old and new in our music, something that doesn't exist today. If it is the gospel, if it is the Church of Jesus Christ that can create the only possibility of community among mankind in our culture, then why should not the worship and praise of God and the answer to God's grace and his gospel create the only synthetic, real synthesis, real rebirth of musical and artistic expression? Why not? I believe that it can. I believe the church is called to this task, and to a task no less than this. And when this happens, it will be an offering which nobody but we could possibly make. And it will be an offering of a kind that could rise only in our time and place. And I believe that we are all called together to this task, and that it is the task of us all. Thank you from the bottom of my heart for the joy. I'm sorry I didn't hear you. There should have been a trumpet, you know. We couldn't have everything in one day.
Yeah. I would like to know how you would conceive of implementing this use of the gospel or of the communion of saints, if you want to call it that, in creating a new synthesis of worship music. Do you have any particular specifics in mind when you say that?
No, I don't have specifics in mind. Beginning... I think that the church has to begin with certain traditional music that it has. And it has to begin to study and use these. And I think that for the moment, we shall have to draw on older traditions, and there will be a series of them, not one. And I think that if we draw on popular music, we shall have to do the same thing. I think that we have to study the possibilities of blues. In St. Louis, I should not have to apologize for the language of the blues. I think that we have to study the possibilities and experiment with it. I think it'll be experimentation along these lines, knowing that this is not the music of everybody yet. But I think that we have to also work with other possibilities. And I'm talking now not about the creation of music for the choir, so much as I'm talking about the music that belongs in the speech, including hymn tunes.
speech of the church. Now, this is a very definite answer, but my thinking hasn't gone further than this. Yes. I am pessimistic, sir. I think that before we can have a community's music, we must have a community. Of course, this is within the possibility of God's grace, you know. It is within the possibility of God's grace for all mankind to be saved together. The pessimism is not due to anything in God. The pessimism is due to what's in man. Yes, I think that this experiment of Beaumont is a sound experiment. The trouble is that it's just the first one. And the trouble is that, of course, those of us who listen to it as something as sort of a fad, something strange. And of course, it has to be used over and over and over again until it does no longer seem strange before we'll know whether it's any good or not. But after listening to a great deal of music, which I've had to do in the last year, and study it from the point of view of worship, I had a higher respect for it when I came back to it after a year's work than I had when I first heard it. For English people, but just to the degree in which it suits the people of England, it isn't for Americans, maybe. This particular music, but I think it is a sound experiment. This is what I mean, the kind of thing I mean. Of course, we've got another thing to say, that the musical style in England has changed since it was composed. Now, that's the trouble with popular styles. You've got nothing as permanent in it. It's the difficulty.
We have a canon of the local Episcopal Cathedral that's experimenting with St. Louis here.
Well, we have an Episcopal priest with St. Louis jazz. We have an Episcopal priest in the Chicago area that's experimenting with jazz, but it's not St. Louis particularly, not blues. The other kind of music. Of course, this little experiment of the Methodists is not a fair experiment because they haven't done anything but put instrumental jazz background to the spoken text of John Wesley's service. So I don't think that it's a significant experiment at all. Yeah.
Like having evening church with a jazz band coming in through the open window.
Yeah, it's kind of that way, yes.
Do you believe the so-called gospel is more natural to many Americans?
I had an argument with my wife yesterday. She thinks that the history of music ended with Mozart. When I tried to tell her that there was something, some freshness, some ideal of improvisation in Mahalia Jackson's singing of gospel songs, which I think is very, very ancient, but also perhaps points the way to an emancipation of music once again in the future sometimes when creative persons come along, emancipation from the rigid hold of scientific. I have some suspicion that the limitation of our contemporary music is that its scientific theory holds it too tight. It's too much dominated by rationalism. But I don't know. This is can be only conjecture. Yes.
I was speaking more of the type of music you find in Youth for Christ organizations.
No, I don't think so, because the styles in this change so fast, too. Since I was a boy, I grew up on gospel songs. I heard them all, but this was a different kind of music from what we hear in the gospel songs now. I don't think there's any, but I think the church could well look into this music and say, what is it that makes it tick? Maybe there is something there. There is a freshness and a naturalness of using the harmonic progressions, for example, of using a very simple harmonic scheme once again. Of course, professional musics would hate to go back to this. You know what I mean, tonic, subdominant and dominant chords, and a few other modulations and nothing else. But a certain simplicity of utterance there, which maybe deserves more study than it's been given. And of course, all of my answers are maybes. Mm-hmm.
The man in the balcony, please.
You mentioned a synthesis of architecture as being an important comparison for us. Only when architecture is synthesized now, we also came up with some new materials. I was wondering what you were thinking of in the area of music.
There's always something that seems brand new, and it never is quite brand new. I think that the handling of walls and even the handling of space, we talk so much about space in architecture here today, but I think the concept of space is not a new concept. We're realizing its importance again. But I think if you go back to the earliest use in Byzantine architecture, you will also find a very vivid use of space. These things that are new just seem to be new. And nothing is ever created that's independent of its past. We are the past. We are history, perhaps. I don't know how to answer your question clearly in a few words, but do you see what I'm driving at? If not, ask again.
Well, my question in particular, for example, use of steel.
Yes. Oh, yes. Well, this we have to understand changes, because this is material substance that changes and ways of building. And I think that any honest art must use the resources that it has available. I even think that any honest musical art has to experiment with electronics. Yeah, this will sound crazy to us, you know, because nothing is going to be created until it becomes music. And yet, I think electronics is part of our present stuff to work with in music. And we have to work with steel and glass because they're our way of building. I think the church has to do this in every age, in all the arts. Well, I think the answer to that is that our liturgies and all everything that goes into our liturgical worship must undergo the test of biblicity. It must be biblical, and most of our liturgy is biblical. This is why it's ageless. See, in Dr. Buzin's class, I'm going to play a Congo Mass, where a bunch of men and boys in the Congo sing the Latin text of the ordinary of the Mass all the way through to African music. It's the text of the liturgy that holds us here. It's its spoken utterance here, I think. Because I do not think that music, I doubt very much that music has a correct or incorrect theological quality.
One more.
Yes, I think we shouldn't. Well, I don't have to come to the Missouri Synod Church for that. I don't know much about it yet, because this, you've got no monopoly on this situation. I think that we have to be prepared to to see something that isn't a deadly uniformity that spreads all over. I think it's going to be a variation. I hope that the Midwest never comes to sing like the East sings. See, I was educated in Philadelphia. You know what I mean. I think the music of the church music of the East Coast, I don't know the Missouri Synod in the East, is provincial. I think it's far below the degree of music in the Midwest, and partly because the Midwest has had such brilliant leadership from institutional choirs like yours, like St. Olaf, beginning with St. Olaf, perhaps, maybe. And I think that there'll be some regional differences here, and I think there'll be differences between large congregations in the church and smaller congregations, and I think that the musical treasure of the church has to be rich enough to make room for both of them. I believe this too.